Thank you for extending the invitation. And I'll just second what you, well, thank you for participating in my manuscript workshop, of course. And also for you all joining or, you know, in conversation, even though the text of mine that you read has been like published and written and it's sort of a fait accompli now, it doesn't mean like the broader ideas and things that I'm thinking through can't change and aren't in a process right now. So really anything, questions, comments, clarifications that you all have is actually things that are, you know, are part of the process of a broader project. And so I appreciate anything once we get to the Q&A. It's not like it's a done deal period and done generally. So I thought about how maybe what I was just going to take some time by just giving a little bit of context to this particular piece in terms of what my broader research project looks like, explain some sort of operational categories and a history of them, so then we can then sort of think through the questions or comments or whatever you all have for afterwards. And I'm particularly trying to, I saw the phenomenal syllabus of thinking reproductive rights as human rights. And so I'll try to keep it, you know, in relationship to what I imagine some of the conversations that you've all been having. So just like right off the bat, this particular chapter is in edited volume primarily directed towards international relations scholars, political scientists, and I'm an anthropologist and I'm doing ethnography. And so my interest is less in actually measuring the success or effectiveness or identifying the conditions that sort of engender affirmation or confirmation of LGBT rights or human rights, which is kind of the tone of some of the questions that the scholarship that I'm engaging with is asking. But my questions are not really in that space. So that's sort of one thing that I wanted to explain. And this sort of elision of the case of Peru, when people write or think, scholars often think about LGBT rights and the status of rights in Latin America, often the sort of exemplary cases of Argentina or Chile, and even Brazil, especially when we're thinking about the relationship between the LGBT rights movement and the AIDS activism and movement, are often sort of stand in for how Latin America is conceptualized. And so thinking through this really provincial, out of the way place as actually intimately intertwined with global phenomenon in LGBT rights and HIV AIDS prevention is also just something that I thought was helpful with this for in relationship to the piece that you read and the book in which it's situated. And I'm sorry, I'm like going on with a million precursor things. So basically my research was in the Peruvian Amazon. And I was specifically interested in the consequences of HIV prevention initiatives among gay and trans communities in the Peruvian Amazon. One thing, I'm sorry, you can tell I'm a very sort of talkative person. As soon as I go beyond 15 minutes or the timing of your class, do feel free to interrupt me in the middle of it and stop me. Of course, I could probably talk forever. I won't be offended. So we can just get on to the next half of things. All right. So I was primarily in the city that's referenced in this piece in Tarapoto. But I was also working in the port cities of the Peruvian Amazon. One is Iquitos and the other one's Pucallpa, where over the past decade, HIV prevention programs have been implemented in those three principal cities, primarily through the funding of an entity called the Global Fund to Fight HIV, AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria. I'll just sort of shorten that to the Global Fund, but that's the sort of shorthand for where what's propelling financially and discursively the changes in HIV prevention that have been happening in Peru and in the Peruvian Amazon over the past two decades. To give a little bit, so I'm going to talk sort of like broad historical past two decades and then like connect that to the timing of my actual fieldwork, which is like 2012 to 2018-ish. But to do that, I just want to go back a little bit in time to the year 2000. And I'm going to just kind of tell this quick story of 2000 to 2030. And you'll see that like, okay, this phenomena is pieced within in that period. And so in the year 2000 was when the Millennium Development Goals were established, or and maybe I'm sort of repeating a lot of things that you all have been talking about in class, but so the UN member states agree on the Millennium Development Goals in 2000, putting the year 2015 as like the end game, the objective to achieve these things called the Millennium Development Goals. There's a lot of them. In fact, that was one of the common critiques, is like how many goals there were for 15 years. But one of them has to do with ending and curtailing the spread of HIV/AIDS by the year 2015. So the idea is that like this abstract goal agreed upon by the UN in 2000 is that by 2015, we would sort of halt and reduce the spread of HIV globally. So the way that that like got translated into practice or action was this thing called the 15 by 15 objective. That was like the technical goal that then was that translation of that broader idea. And it was to provide 15 million people globally with antiretroviral therapy by the year 2015. So because of like more effective combination therapies, because of the growth of like generic markets in India and Brazil and other companies, it became like post 2000 much more feasible to actually widely distribute effective antiretroviral therapy. And the global community like makes this 15 by 15 goal. They make it like before 2015. And this was huge because it's like all of these goals, of course, are so like ideal, abstract and broad. And it's not very common when, you know, you can actually sort of evidence like, look, we made it. And with time to spare, by 2014, they had sort of counted 15 million people having received antiretroviral therapy. So this like sparked a lot of enthusiasm that, oh, this like goal of reversing HIV by 2015 can actually happen. And so like in that moment of enthusiasm, this like new goal happens, and it's a goal for the year 2020. So by 2020, the new target is what comes to be called the 90-90-90 objectives. And these are sort of passed to all the countries and said, your goal now that you've sort of oriented yourselves to distribution of antiretroviral therapy, now we want to target this new goal. And this one is called 90 because 90 is like the number. So it means 90% of all people living with HIV are aware of their status. So it's like ramping up testing. 90% of all people who are living with HIV who are aware of their status are on antiretroviral therapy. And then 90% of everyone who is on antiretroviral therapy achieves an undetectable viral load. And so this becomes like right in the middle of this period that I'm studying HIV prevention, things get like reoriented and shifted towards 90-90-90 objective. And again, like following all of this enthusiasm, this new objective, new targets, like we can do it. In 2015, when the UN revises the Millennium Development Goals to like the Sustainable Development Goals, they say, which are 2015 to 2030, by 2030, we're gonna end AIDS as a global health crisis, or end the threat of AIDS as a global public health crisis. And so this like is where we start hearing this idea of end of AIDS actually primarily voiced through Anthony Fauci. He was a major proponent of, in the United States, sort of creating a goal of an end of AIDS and really bringing that term to the US context. And it's in this sort of 2015 period where end of AIDS becomes this new imaginary for the global community. End of AIDS doesn't necessarily mean that, like, eradication of HIV, which would be like bringing global prevalence to zero. Not a lot of diseases are actually eradicated. But, you know, what it actually means is a matter of dispute. That's like different people are putting, argue different technical markers for what end of AIDS as a global public health crisis by 2030 looks like. And so with like all of this in mind and all of these like new technologies, new ideas, new objectives, I'm sort of tracking that ethnographically among the gay and trans communities in just this part of the world that is actually very affected by HIV. And now that we have a little bit of that history, I just wanted to then maybe talk a little bit about how ideas of human rights then come to interface really intertwine really intimately with the growth and emergence and transformations in LGBT rights, particularly in the Peruvian Amazon. So the thing that's like really important about that is that in the case of Peru, HIV was called what's called a concentrated epidemic. And this is just a technical term that epidemiologists and global health scholars use to define different types of HIV epidemics in different contexts. And so in Peru, it's a concentrated epidemic, which means that over 5% of HIV prevalence is over 5% in a key population. A key population is, again, another technical term. And here it means gay, transgender, and MSM, or men who have sex with men but who do not identify as gay. But other key populations might be injecting drug users, incarcerated people, migrants, refugees. And so there's like a list of who counts as a key population. So when prevalence is over 5% in a key population and less than 1% among pregnant women, then it's categorized as sort of concentrated in a key population. When prevalence is over 1% among pregnant women, that is referred to as a generalized epidemic. And that's supposed to sort of be an indicator of, because many pregnant women around the world are actually tested for HIV, it becomes a proxy for understanding the broader prevalence. And you can have contexts that are both concentrated and generalized. So that would be both prevalence over 5% among a key population and over 1% among pregnant women. But in Peru, that's not the case. In Peru, it's just concentrated. So it doesn't take necessarily, it doesn't sound crazy to think that, oh, if the epidemic is concentrated, then this must be because of social cultural factors. Like, that makes sense. Like, that's something that we would probably all generally agree on, that there must be like social and cultural factors at play that create the context and situation in which some people, like gay and trans individuals, are more exposed to or more affected by the epidemic HIV than others. And so that's when it, like, ideas of discrimination and stigma come to be like operational categories for making sense of how you can have a world in which that, you know, HIV is so concentrated among certain populations. And so when discrimination and stigma, which are like actual things that we observe and see happen in life, come to also be seen as like the operational category that we have to target in order to address HIV being a concentrated epidemic, like, ideas of human rights then come to be like the logical treatment or the illogical sort of assessment of what needs to be done. Like, okay, if we see the reason why gay and trans people aren't proceeding along the HIV care continuum, for instance, which would be, you know, proceeding along that continuum of the 90-90-90 goals. So being tested, getting access to antiretrovirals, achieving viral suppression, then it's like, it's different moments on that continuum where discrimination and stigma are experienced that lead people to not sort of proceed as they ought to in the sort of end of AIDS imaginary. And human rights are then sort of become this other operational category to like address that. So if, you know, if you can sort of instill or create a culture of human rights or teach people to sort of file formal discrimination grievances, learn how to identify discrimination in their everyday lives, then that sort of has that effect of diminishing discrimination and stigma and ideally sort of reducing the concentration of HIV. And so I think like that's in my research where that like the, like that's where the rubber kind of meets the road when we're thinking about this, like if we're thinking in the framing of your course, like LGBT rights as human rights, like this is one space where that gets like messy or that gets played out and implemented and operationalized. So all of that, I'm sure I'm like going way beyond your time for class to say, so where do we get to like these stories of, you know, violence towards trans women during Peru's internal armed conflict and this like march that happened in 2000? What I'm like trying to do in this piece, and at least how I imagine it in the broader sort of story that I'm really trying to tell, or like that's being authored now, you know, these days as we speak, is like a question of, as a place like Tarapoto, which is really kind of sight unseen, especially in Peru, where the capital city, Lima, is really a lot of the center of attention, so to speak. You, on the one hand, have all of these like incredible accomplishments and this ability to carry out and actually implement the abstract goals of end of AIDS that are sort of being handed to them by global NGOs, international entities, the UN, capital city Lima, when even in Lima, with all of the resources and with all of the expertise and et cetera, like they're like unable to happen. And as opposed to sort of asking, you know, how can this, like, what are the conditions in Tarapoto that would then sort of make that scale up, like make other places in the world be able to reproduce those accomplishments? I kind of take a different route. I mean, of course, like, I think we all would be invested in something like that. But I'm like, what I was looking at, or like what my data kind of helped me see, was how people themselves were historicizing in the sense of like making historical all of these like accomplishments that are coming from the carrying out of global directives and targets regarding HIV. And that's sort of where you get these like diverging stories. And so if everyone sees sort of, you know, establishing a municipal anti-discrimination ordinance that includes sexual orientation, gender identity, and everyone sees creating a tripartite agreement between the Ministry of Health, the municipality, and the LGBT rights organization as this other like accomplishment on the way towards end of AIDS by 2030, I was curious, how are people seeing them as like part of different historical trajectories? Like what are they thinking are how these are, like what histories are they putting in to sort of explain how these can come about? So it's like, in a way, a different question than the one of scalability. And that's like where you get those two stories. And so for some of my interlocutors, like this municipal anniversary parade that was put on by the Lions Club that they like fought for their opportunity to be in the year 2006, you know, that where there's like, that's not going to show up in any like record or show up in any report or show up in any sort of like gray materials about the sort of history of HIV and Peru's response to HIV, becomes like the spot where they're like, this is why we were able to do this. And for others, it was this longer legacy of homophobic violence, transphobic violence as a result of the internal armed conflict that had been happening you know, decades before into the 1980s and 1990s. And that's where those two sort of like collide. So I'll just like finish that there. Apologies again if I went too long. I know you all have a million, you had great things to read in class. So probably plenty to say, but just, you know, as we go continue with our conversation, I'm happy to talk about either the piece or the research, or, I mean, if you're interested in two cents about Peru's response to COVID or relationship to HIV, like whatever's really on your all minds now. I know a lot of things are probably on your mind. So wherever you feel you're want to take the conversation, I'm happy to go in any direction.